something like that, you know. So, anyway. And then I study my computer stuff. I have no idea whether or not it's going to save my ass in the end, depending on how bad things get, but it keeps me...
Well, I think it's just
focusing my attention on something that I find interesting, and I study it, and I learn a little more about it every day, and exercise my brain, and it keeps my mind off of drifting around on all the horrible things I could be thinking about.
Yeah, like all this economic shit.
Focus on after I get the networking certification is computer security, because I think this identity theft thing is getting way out of hand. So I might be able to carve a little niche for myself in that area, helping people to keep their information secure, knowing what to look out for in terms of ways in which people can steal your information, and then, you know, helping people to protect themselves against that.
That's great. That's really important. I think you're right. I think if you can get into that area, because especially in this environment, I mean, it's been going on all along, but it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I heard something with James with one of those shows that Bob was congratulating James for something he did, finding out about some identity theft computer thing. Did you hear that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what that's about?
I don't know the details. Oh. James is always reporting on the latest thing where some data was ripped off of some big company that had a lot of people's personal information. But those are the kinds of things he pays attention to, because it supports his gig, you know.
Yeah. Are you still listening to that?
Yeah.
Because you listen to everything Bob does, I think. Right?
Yeah, I pay attention. I follow Bob. Isn't it interesting? I mean, I don't know what, you know, you might think this is trivial or silly, but it's interesting, the sort of coincidental occurrences that occur between, like, Bob says that a lot of times the things that he's doing right now in his life in present time end up becoming reflected in the media. Well, there's this TV show on Fringe. Have you heard about it?
Mm-hmm.
It's I don't recommend it, because it's not the acting is not great, the production values are not great, and so on. But Bob's been talking to Walter Bovard through the channel, or the medium, as it were. You know, Walter wrote the book Operation Mind Control.
He talked to him through James.
Yeah. So I tune in. I didn't go out.
I remember your comment, though.
What was that?
Why would you consult with him?
With who?
With Walter.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's just you know, this series of coincidences was really interesting, because I had no interest in watching the show Fringe, but somebody kept bringing it to my attention. You know, I share this house with a woman, and she watches a lot of TV. She thought it would be something that I would be interested in. Basically, you know, I wouldn't watch it at all, except I got hooked, and I'll tell you why. She prompted me to watch it. So the first episode, I noticed, is about this guy named Walter, who's at the center of this mind control operation, where he's both being a victim and he's doing exactly what Walter did. He feels that he's being a victim of this mind control that's going on around him. He sees it going on within the government, and it's beginning to permeate the culture. And he's investigating into it, and he's sort of being, he's being sort of manipulated and mind controlled himself. And at the same time, he's delving deeper into trying to find the source of this mind control operation. And the way that the guy, the way that they make him up, first of all, he wears his hair, his hair looks, he wears his hair like Bob, and he actually looks like Bob, except that he's, he's kind of puffy, and he looks, he's not, doesn't look as healthy as Bob. But, like on the first or second episode, there was this thing where was investigating this guy who'd had some kind of by the mind control situation. He'd had some kind of crystalline stuff injected into his bloodstream, which was causing his brain to become synchronized with the electronic media. So now this guy's like getting, you know, his brain is half human and half electronic media. And and I'm watching the credits. At the end of the credits, there's, I see this thing called Human Scale Productions, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And but then I forgot about it. And a little while later, I thought, I'm gonna look that up. So I look up Human Scale Productions, and the first thing I notice is that it's this guy named Doug Carr, who's a 25-year-old filmmaker. He makes short films, and he did this film on LSD, the history of LSD 25. His name's Doug Carr. Well, Bob and I have been interviewing this guy in India, which I recorded and put up on the website. He and Bob's friend David Worster were the first people to experiment with LSD 25. The guy in India's name is Bob Carr. So right immediately there's this weird coincidence. This Doug Carr does a film on LSD 25. Bob and I are talking to this guy in India, Bob Carr, who was one of the first people to actually work with LSD 25. He and Worster developed the models that Timothy Leary then went on to use when he started Millbrook. And then I read a little further. The guy's current project is about a guy named Dobbs, D-O-B-B-S. Apart from the fact that he's creating a movie about Dobbs, there's nothing else that appears to synchronize with Bob's life, because this guy, this movie about this guy named Dobbs who his marriage is breaking up and he's got all these problems and stuff. It doesn't sound like anything that's going on in Bob's life, but that's weird. So then we go to Wikipedia and look up this guy, and he says he was born in Paris and moved to Nova Scotia. Well, as long as I've known Bob, he said that he was born in Paris before he moved to Nova Scotia. This guy has offices in Nova Scotia and New York, which is, Bob was, when he was living in New York, was constantly moving between Nova Scotia and New York. So I send all this information to Bob, the website and everything, and Bob starts finding all these other little nuggets of things that correspond to direct references to things that Bob's either involved with or has been involved with in the past. So, you know, I don't know that there's much to make about it.
Well, I'll tell you what I make of it.
What?
That this guy does know about Bob Dobbs, that he has been listening about Bob Dobbs. I mean, he could tune into Bob Dobbs at any point and get all that information that you've just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could have watched the videos that we did.
Right.
He happened on that.
Right.
He could have been
he did the thing.
Hollywood writers.
Yeah.
If you notice, almost everything that they do is taken out of newspapers or stories that they read.
Right.
They're always looking for stuff. If they're connected enough to get things made,
right,
they don't have the kind of minds necessarily to create them,
yeah,
you know, from you know, scratch. They are taking a little story in the newspaper.
He didn't fictitiously create his name. His name is Doug Carr. I don't think he created a Wikipedia entry saying that he was born in Paris if he wasn't born in Paris. The film that he did on LSD 25 was done 5 years ago.
I know, but he could have looked up Bob Dobbs that long ago. In other words, he could have heard Bob Dobbs when we did.
That's possible.
He could have been playing in his mind, and he could have been playing that game, and he might have looked it up because of the connections.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was from here, and you don't know if he was really, you know, some of those Wikipedia things aren't true. by the way.
Oh, yeah, sure. You can put anything you want in there.
Yeah, so...
But people, but you see, these things are inspected by people, friends and colleagues and so on. People will go in and put corrections in if they think that you're not telling the truth.
He could make up a false identity just like Bob does.
Yeah.
And he could have found him through that original name that is the same. You know, because he was looking up. I do that. I've gone and looked names up similar to names in my family and stuff. Or any names that, I mean, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm just talking from the perspective of what I know writers do.
Mm-hmm.
They do it all the time. Hollywood constantly does it. The joke is, this is already being written. When you see it on the, you know, this is, oh, somebody's writing this one now.
Right.
And then you see it. Or we'll turn on a TV movie. Did you read that last 6 months ago? Yes. You know, exact same storyline. They come up all the time on series and everything. I don't know why somebody wouldn't do that. Especially Bob would be a perfect target for it as an insider joke.
Right.
Guy. You know what I mean? Because they do that.
Yeah.
And Bob's story, I mean, and wouldn't you not be too surprised if it ends up paralleling even more, you know, as the story goes on,
mm-hmm.
What you know about Walter.
Oh, yeah, there was this scene I don't know if I probably told you this story because I thought it was so sort of outrageous, but when we were in L.A., when I was in L.A. last, and it was late, and we were just out driving around trying to kill time, Bob said, as we were getting into the car, that he was interested in getting... He just said it. He didn't go on. He didn't say anything else. He mentioned he was interested in having a milkshake.
It came into his
mind.
Right.
We ended up at the Cafe 50s.
Right.
He ends up, like, drinking four.
Right.
After having food. I mean, I've never seen... I don't know how it's possible that anybody could have actually consumed that much food, but...
It didn't make him feel good, remember? He looked pretty sick.
He looked kind of dazed for a while. So, I mean, why did he do that to himself? You know, what possessed him to do it? Well, I'm watching Fringe, and this guy, this Walter guy goes, somebody get me a root beer float. I've got to have a root beer float. And he says it like three times during the film. And then there's a scene where he's sitting in the cafe, and I swear he looks like Bob, and he's sitting there, and he's got this huge root beer float, and he's sucking it down. And there was like no reason why this should even be in the film. It was just a weird non sequitur. And I had this experience of like, this is too weird to be true.
Well, what if Bob is actually connected to this guy that's writing this? Maybe he knows him.
No, he doesn't.
How do you know that? Now, you know Bob lies, because you've seen him in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
You know he does.
Yeah.
He will lie right to your face. And you know that Bob, when Terry asked him, well, what about your... Because he was asking us all these questions about our family and stuff.
Right.
And it pissed Terry off. And he says, well, what about yours? And he just... He looked down, and that was the end of the story.
No, Bob is adamant about his family life, but nobody believes him. You know, that his father was born and was part of the
Oh, but yeah.
What do you call that group? The something of Prion, weird esoteric group of Illuminati. And all this stuff. Bob is weird. I don't know. I see. Normally, I'm offended by people who would lie or try to be deceitful.
I'm going to tell you, say something. I need to say this. Just between you and me.
Yeah.
Because I know how important Bob. I think I know how important Bob is to you. I didn't say anything before, but I was very upset when he came here last time.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you sensed that.
Yeah, I did.
Because of the way he kept calling in the afternoon. Have you heard from Scott? Where's Scott? And I tried to call Scott, and I called his house, and you go, what the hell is he thinking? You know, basically just losing it.
Actually, right.
Total asshole. And then he says to me, if Scott calls, I want you to tell him, ordering me, you tell him that he's just really ruined everything. You know, he's wasting my time and held me. Like, you know, I heard Scott was down on the beach and I can't get a hold of him. And I'm going, I was...
The funny thing is that he was mirroring what was going on with me. I was feeling that. I was extremely upset. I was down on the beach and I was extremely
upset
with Bob.
I thought you should have been upset because he was having you hang out at his beck and call the whole time. I was so pissed at him.
Right.
I didn't say anything. I just said, yeah, sure, and I hung up the phone.
Right.
And I did not say that to you.
Right.
I would never have said that to you. I didn't even want to see Bob.
Right.
I thought, you know, you asshole.
Yeah.
How can you treat people like this that care about you?
Right.
You know, that just...
Yeah.
I didn't know. I didn't know if you felt bad about it or what you knew about it.
No, I was on the beach, and I was angry with him because I was feeling put off for some reason or another.
You were being put off.
And I was sort of intentionally playing games and I wasn't really intentionally playing games. I got down to the beach. I promised I'd call him. I had a cell phone. I got down to the beach and I was out of range. So I tried to call him. I couldn't get the phone to work. There was this weird communication problem that was occurring. Usually I'm pretty reliable, but in this case I was appearing to be unreliable, and I was angry with him for various reasons.
Well,
he was freaking out and being angry with me, and I don't know if we were just mirroring each other or what was going on.
I mean, look, he was calling, you know, I might get to do this and I might get to do that, and Scott will be here to pick me up when I need him, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And like she said to me when Carolyn called, she says, oh, Scott was over here and he's kind of like, poor Scott, he's kind of like hanging out there with nobody and doesn't know what to do,
right?
You know, something like that. And I thought, well, fuck this. It's like all of, you know, yeah, Bob is narcissistic.
Yeah.
The more I know about Bob, the more I think he's really narcissistic.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised at anything.
Right.
But, I mean, you can hang out with him and meet people and go places, but when he wants to, you know, I don't know. Like you told me, Bob knows really powerful people, and I can't even tell you who, and I'm going, I wonder if you actually met them or Bob just told you that.
Right.
Because, see, I don't believe anything out of Bob's mouth.
Right.
And Carolyn kept telling him, oh, if you had watched it, and Terry has it recorded,
uh-huh,
part of it, because he left his damn recorder on, and this was supposed to be super secret because it was all about Walter's women.
Mm-hmm.
It's around here someplace. We never even listened to it, but I said, you had that recorder on. So it took a lot of it, and you would hear Bob trying to, pumping Carolyn. Well, what year was that? What was it? You know, he couldn't remember any of this stuff. And he was going to go back and refresh his memory and memorize it because this was his new game. Walter Bowert now, suddenly.
Right.
You know, because Walter had died and he was going to make something of this with what's his face? James. And James, James is a salesman.
Yeah.
He just basically was an actor.
Right.
And an agent. I mean, you can't go any lower.
Right.
And a salesperson.
Right.
I just, it's like, and he sat right here in front of us and said every single damn thing that Bob told me that he was channeling.
Mm-hmm.
Before, you know, he ever started channeling, before he went off and did that whatever he did. So, no, I am very skeptical of things.
Right.
What I liked about Bob, and I don't know anymore since I've watched him do some of this stuff, was the way he treated people on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see him treating people that way. We were all very, very attentive to Bob, if you notice.
Mm-hmm.
Always. But the minute you're not totally attentive to Bob, he's gone.
Right.
He's got to be the total center. And it's so alarming that a person his age, and he has charm, see that you just don't really believe what you're seeing. It's sort of like the Mormon guy that we were dealing with. When after this all ended, I went back and look at my records,
mm-hmm,
and I find my notes and the dates, because time has a different sense when you're paying attention to every little detail that's going on, and you don't get a picture of, oh my gosh, it was you know, if you kept a record of everything you did when you were hanging out with Bob, mm-hmm. and wrote down, oh, he did this and I did that, and then he told me to go here, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you went back and looked at it, you might have a very different view of it.
Right.
What happened with this guy was he called me on a Friday, us, and said, oh, you might have heard that your mother was trying to escape with her wheelchair, but she can't get out of here at this rest home where they had told us she would be probably till she died,
mm-hmm.
at least for 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a Tasmanian devil, as Terry says. Cut off one head and she grows two.
Right.
So anyway, he says, she's not going to get out of here. And I says, well, how are you going to keep her there and keep in her good graces? And he says, well, I'm going to use the doctors. Oh, and by the way, I don't think it's a good idea for you to call her for a few days. Just don't call her very often, because I think that makes her want to get out of here. And I'm not going to come by as often. That was Friday. On Wednesday, he brought the lawyers in, and they wrote a new will.
Hmm.
And then on the next Sunday, she was home.
Hmm.
And she was home because she told the doctors, I do not accept your treatment. You cannot keep me here.
Mm-hmm.
Those very words. And he quoted those to us, and so did the woman from hospice, or the hospital, I don't know who Terry talked to. And between that Friday and that Wednesday, she says, I have to be patient. It won't be long. Twice to Terry. He noted in their conversations, and I saw that, and I thought, what happened? Because after that, whenever she discussed the will, she would talk about the doctor wrote the will.
Uh-huh.
The doctor was causing problems. She was very confused the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
In and out of confusion, you've got to say. But when she was talking about that, she'd get very irate about the doctor, and then she said some Hollywood writer wrote it, but she would confuse the doctor with the will. And I believe that the lawyer, I mean, that this Bruce, this bishop, Mormon bishop guy told her, just be patient. I'm going to bring Mr. Hogan, the lawyer, in to finalize the will. And he'll tell you what to say to the doctors to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. But I couldn't see that, and because the cliche part of him telling us don't call her as often,
mm-hmm.
that's such a cliche from like a movie that you don't believe it.
Right.
So it's like with Bob, it's such a cliche of his, you know, being such a, he's such an overblown, obvious narcissist that you don't believe he really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, my experience with him is that he's totally honest with what's going on with him in the moment, and for that reason, I can trust him, even if he's being a complete dick. We can honestly argue about it. I've come across many people who, for whatever reason, to protect their own ego, or for some manipulative, subtle self-preservation type thing. They're kind of deceptive, and you can't really honestly be present with them in the moment.
But you give Bob a whole lot of a leeway.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You do, because of that sense that, oh, he's real straight with me.
Yeah.
And there is a truth.
And fair. I mean, you know, I didn't ask, but he paid for my gas and some of my expenses while I was down there.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think that that's only right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I felt bad about that. I'm glad. Thank you for telling me that.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't ask. I was fine with me either way. But he volunteered that. And
because you do, you know, I mean, you give him so much.
Well, I get something in return. You know, otherwise I wouldn't do it. You'd just call it, you know, I don't know. It may just simply be kind of an exploration or something, you know. I don't know. But I get so bored by everyday television, radio, news events, the mundane world that we live in, and all of the idiocracy of it. And Bob's a playmate, even if he's even if he appears at times to be a rival brother or something like that. He's just a playmate for me, and we have fun.
I guess the reason I brought it up now was because we were talking about this this series, you know, this, what did you call it?
Fringe.
Fringe, and those kind of things, and the him saying that he knows this and that. I mean, he is not...
Bob had no interest in the show. He did not direct me to it. Well, I discovered it on my own. I brought these things to his attention, and he was as surprised as I was, as I was describing to him
these
funny coincidences.
Bob is a great actor. He is.
Well, if he is, he may be actually fooling himself, or he believes that he's working on a higher level, which justifies whatever acting he may do.
I don't even.
I've seen him tell people in all sincerity that he's born in like 1922, and that the D cell is what's been keeping him and Carolyn looking young all these years and so on. I've heard him tell people that. Not on the radio, but in intimate setting, and he appears to be convinced that it's true. I mean, I've never seen anybody with a greater sense of sort of open vulnerability, being honest. Like he believes he's.
That's why when I
think he's a fucking walk-in sometimes. You know what a walk-in is? Maybe there's such a thing as a real walk-in, where like some other kind of spirit possesses your body. Or maybe there's a thing where someone just goes through some weird psychological, psychological transformation or something.
I can do that. I'm an actress. I can do the same thing.
But why would you? Why would you take on it? You would do that for a performance, but not for your whole life.
He's a performance artist. His life is a performance.
Well, he's an he bills himself as the greatest artist alive. I think he's a tremendous.
If
it boils down to the fact that's the bottom line, he's a performance artist. He's a great artist.
Yes, that's right. Let me tell you this. I believe that that's what he does. I think that that's what he is. And here's the thing.
And on many levels.
Every person is acting. Their life is, they're playing a role. Bob knows he is. That's what I think. But I think that what you're saying is you think he forgets it sometimes. I don't think he ever forgets it. I think that's his game. That's what keeps him on a high like you.
Well, Carolyn is probably keeps him grounded.
I think that he has a different relationship with Carolyn. I think he can let go and snore or whatever he does and be who he is. But I do think that he is always on, and that's his high. And his high is maintaining this difference. I have watched him do this, where he has to flip from one persona thing to another because of having a mixed group. I can't recall.
Yeah, well, he says he's quadraphonic, and he does. He has four people that he does.
And he
flips in and out of them, and he thinks one of them is sort of you could say is his chip body. One of them is his TV body. One of them is his chemical body, and one of them is his astral body. That's fucking brilliant. I honestly believe this. I'll go out on a limb and say this. I think in ten or 15 years, as crazy and far out as he sounds today, he's going to start making sense to people. This whole idea of media ecology is going to become an area of investigation.
Well,
and I think he'll become like a fetish for people in the same way that maybe Aleister Crowley is a fetish for people today.
Well, he already is. For some people.
Oh, yeah, small, but there's no cults that have grown up around him.
But, you know, what I'm saying is he is aware of the fact of this. He's living this thing with a conscious awareness of the fact that we create our own persona, and we are a reflection of all of these.
Somehow we create our circumstances, because he goes on intuition. He puts himself way out on a limb, and then as things present himself, he moves on them. He moves instinctually on what's happening, what's appearing. And that means if he needs to go to London to go meet with, to do a surprise meeting with Chris Story, he'll do that. You know, I mean, and...
And so you want to live like that?
Well,
to some degree. I mean,
no, I just want my life to be my life.
Yes, but that's his life, and he is living his life. He's taking the authority for his life. He's the author of his life.
Yeah.
So at every moment when he's picking his brain, through his own brain, you can watch him decide what tack to take with stuff, and he does it so fluidly. It's amazing. I mean, that's what I enjoy watching him do. That's why I could sit and just watch.
Do you know when I was in, I mentioned this in an email, I don't know if you noticed it, but when we were in L.A. in June, several times he used the phrase with me, he said, the economy is a dead cat bounce.
Yes, the dead cat bounce.
That started appearing in the news like 3 weeks ago. I'd never heard that phrase before, and on CNN they were using that phrase. And he also predicted that it was all collapsing. And that was back in June when oil prices were going up and nobody was thinking about the banks collapsing.
Well, people were.
Well, Bob had certainty about it. You know, he said he and his team, you know, whatever.
The woman that you forwarded, she'd written her book. There were so many people that had been warning about this. Lots of people. You just weren't paying attention to that. But Bob pays attention to all those things. That's what he does.
He's tracking them well because he's you know, I've been hearing about banking crises and the Illuminati taking over and all the paranoid conspiracies for years, but I haven't been able to actually sort of map it out for you and in real time. And so Bob is attuning himself to the truth of the matter as best as he can, and it may not be 100%. Like, if we don't see this cold fusion, then I guess we'll have to say either he's a liar or he believes that he is attuned to what's going, that the electronic media and his brain have some kind of dance going on together, and if there's any way that he can generate the thought form that we kind of bring in cold fusion, because it's all we have left to hope for. You know, it's either going to happen or it won't. I hear your belief that it's not a possibility, but there are like 200 laboratories out there that would tell you that they believe that they're onto something with it.
If it happens, it's still not going to solve these banking problems. It's still not going to solve the...
No, but it'll represent the biggest paradigm shift that's ever happened in the history of civilization, the history of culture.
Because people don't understand what's going on around them anyway. They're a bunch of idiots. And if you have this shift and you have all this energy, what will that do? It's just like we had the
computer,
but
it means that human beings will no longer organize themselves around a hierarchy of power. It means that every human being can start their own little space with their own little energy battery and create their own little community, a local community. We don't have to live in a global cyberspace. We could actually start having neighbors again.
Well, that's an ideal, and that would be really great. But you know what? That's just one possibility. Why do we end up like we are right now? We could still have solar on our roofs and live separately. You know? Now everybody's afraid of their computers because of this crime. You know, we're going to get my identity stolen, so we can't go on and order on the computer or whatever. I don't know. I just think that you have to deal with human nature first. And human nature
is not going to change.
Like a mass, you know, and stupid.
Right.
Although some people say the mass is not so stupid, it appears to me to be pretty stupid.
No, group mind is always lowest common denominator.
Well, I don't know. They've done some studies later and said that the group mind actually comes up with the right idea. Right now.
Well, there's probably some basic survival instinct that is forged maybe in the crisis of the group mind when
I heard Bob say one time, if cold fusion isn't happening, then we're lost. He said that.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
He doesn't say totally it's going to happen.
Right.
You know, he's never
said... No, he's...
He does
right.
Stop sounding Right.
He feels he has a level of responsibility to help to birth it, because he believes that he's found the trim tab, that Bucky Fuller, you ever hear trim tab?
You got
an airplane and it's got, you know, all these flaps on the wings and the tails, and you know, there's like 10 flaps and they all have to operate in a coordinated fashion in order for the thing to be able to fly. This thing called a trim tab, which is boils down to a little lever that you can pull, and it moves everything in a coordinated fashion. All the parts, all these disjointed parts that ordinarily wouldn't work together.
I think that Bob definitely wants to put out a positive message to people. That's very important, you know.
I think it's more than that. I think he honestly feels that he has to do this. His life is almost at stake or something. I mean, this is a genuine effort at doing something that he feels is important, that he has to do. I don't think that he would take on. I don't think he would take on all this for personal aggrandizement. I think he feels he's working for a greater good, he has to do this. Otherwise,
I think the greater good, though,
there's no choice.
Is saying things, you know, just being out there with the things that he's pointing to for those people who can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it helps you to believe that cold fusion is going to, you know, get the world into a better place, then you're not going to be as panicked and full of fear. And I think the biggest, and I don't know, Bob doesn't maybe come from this point, I think that, and that's what I heard when he would talk to people, that he didn't ever instill fear in anybody. He never passed on fear.
Right.
Talk about the scariest thing.
That's true. I do end up feeling, I always end up feeling energized after I talk to him, and I feel, and he pulls me out of my doldrums.
Exactly. He gives you a positive float to it. He can talk about those things and then go ahead and laugh in the same breath.
Yeah.
Say, but, you know, we'll be fine because it's already all happened. In other words, you can quit worrying about what you can do to change things. Things are going to go on, and he takes the claim that he knows about these things, which you have enough evidence to think that he may very well know things, which will cause you to feel relaxed. You know, if Bob's okay with it, it's probably okay. And in some respects, even if Bob doesn't know squat, it's still the truth. Do you see what I'm saying? It's still the truth, because if I look at Bob and taking the name Bob as the name of every man, which I always felt that's what it was about, you know, bottom up, everything's decided from the bottom, and I see some evidence of that. You know, we're seeing all kinds of changes just as a result of this sudden economic thing that they're talking about, which who knows why they did that. But what really matters is what happens, what people do. You know, whatever Bob's motive doesn't matter to me. What matters to me, and whether he lies or whatever, what matters to me is what his effect is. And the effect is positive. But when he came here the last time, he was sick. He'd eaten too much milkshakes. Probably that was one reason why he didn't feel good. And he was grumbly at you. And I think it's perfectly okay if you guys had your spat. But there is something under that of some kind of feeling of there's not a balanced respect going on. You know, you're worshiping him. But on the other hand, most of the time, like you say, if you have a connection with Bob, you feel better. So it makes up for anything that he has going on with himself that can be construed as very self-centered, at the least.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, I mean, to put it in simple terms, I've never felt cheated by Bob. And so, you know, the guy's mind is impeccable. So if you want, you know, I can't say that we're peers on that level. But he treats me like a peer, and I expect to be treated like one. And if we, and peers, you know, will have fits of whatever being angry.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, but if I ever feel slighted by him, you know, I don't tend to enjoy the company of people that I feel slighted by. And I've had several friends that where the relationship took on that quality, and I just wasn't interested in continuing to speak with them anymore. So it's not like I lack any self-respect or anything, but and I don't even know if worship is the right word to use, but I do.
Word. I'm sorry.
I find him to be
I think
a
it's
very
true.
Unique person anyway, at the very least.
I think
least.
What you said before was probably more what it is. He stimulates you incredibly.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, when we're on the phone together, he takes an equal interest in me. But he puts his work first. You know what I mean? And, you know, so he has his work to do. And if the work happens to be that we're having a conversation, and we're about to take a look at his chart, or you could say that I'm helping him with his work. And, you know, it's a non-paid position. So why would somebody do that unless they, you know, why would somebody make that sacrifice to work for somebody, to help somebody else with their work, if they weren't getting financially, you know, compensated for it, which I'm not. But I feel that there is a compensation that occurs for whatever way that I do help him with his work. And,
well, I suppose, you know, it's a mutual thing. If you're having these conversations with him, and it's mutually stimulating.
Yeah.
He finds out, he uses that to test, too. He finds out.
He'll always, like, you know, if he feels like maybe he has been unfair with me or something while we're having a conversation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I cut him a lot of slack on that level. You know, I mean, I don't have a lot invested, really, all that much invested in whether or not I feel like I was treated fairly, right down to the minutia. But sometimes we'll hang up, and, you know, and 5 minutes later he calls me back, and he wants to probe around and make sure that, you know, he was fair with me, or that everything is okay, and what have you. So, but he's something that was discouraging to me. We were in the car, and I got a call on the cell phone from my dad, and I thought, oh, my dad's never talked to Bob. He says, Bob, say hi to my dad. So I give Bob the phone, and Bob was being totally inappropriate. And later on, when I talked to my dad said, you know, who was that? He said he made me feel uncomfortable or whatever. And I thought, yeah, that's the place where Bob can't shift and can't sometimes shift into being, I don't know what the word is, but just understand, you know, just normal consideration, human politics or human, not courtesy exactly, but I don't know what the word is.
Carry on, just a hello, how are you?
Right.
Conversation.
Right. Yeah. He was. He actually looked quite. He actually appeared flustered. He kind of didn't know how to handle himself in that circumstance because I threw it something in his lap that was unexpected and it was outside his domain or where his head was at, and he appeared kind of flustered and awkward, and he acted weird. And my dad thought he
on Carolyn for those things, you know.
Yeah.
Would be have a wonderful conversation with your father or mother.
Right.
And give them all kinds of, like, when they were here and
right.
The neighbor came over, Carolyn entertained her when Bob just left the room.
Yeah.
I can't, let me know when she's gone, is what he said.
Right.
And, which is fine. I understand that.
Right.
I'm not comfortable you know, in these kind of situations. You know, I didn't go to my class reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept getting letters from these people saying, you know, everybody's been asking if you were come. And so-and-so says he doesn't think you want. So-and-so said you don't. I'm getting letters from these people. I have only seen one of them
mm-hmm.
in, what, 50 years
mm-hmm.
or whatever? How many? Yeah, 50 years. And I don't want to see these people again. I don't know them. I don't have any. What am I going to talk about?
Well, I had the same thing happen recently. This guy that I used to know was getting all the old gang together for a camp out at, and he wanted me to fly from the L.A. to be part of this, and I made up all kinds of excuses. And then 2 weeks later, he and one of the other guys were planning to fly up here to see me, and I really had no interest in seeing them at all. So I was polite, and I basically the way I handled it was that I handled it in such a way that I sort of let them know that it would be great if all this could happen on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't think I showed them much encouragement, and they just, you know, the energy went out of it, and they dropped the whole thing, so. And I was glad.
I know that those people would, and it's hard to say, you guys will have a lot more fun without me.
Yeah.
Spoil your fun. I'm going to be sitting there thinking, what the fuck am I doing here?
Right.
I understood completely why Bob didn't want to talk to me.
Right.
You know, or be around her, or have his energy sapped
mm-hmm.
by people. And that's how it feels. I feel like I'm, you know, dealing with vampires.
See, another thing about Bob is that I've never met anybody who's as willing as he is to make a complete fool out of himself and have absolutely no problem with that he just that and what people think about that, which I find to be interesting. That and it doesn't drag him down. If I make a fool out of myself, I'm gonna.
What do you mean by making a fool out of himself?
Well, he'll make some outrageous claim, and when people will like roll their eyes and think that he's being an idiot, and he doesn't have a problem with that. Somehow it doesn't drag him down. I don't know anybody else that's like that.
Well, George Bush is like that.
Well, yeah, that's true. And Bob believes in, you know, I think he believes ultimately in what he's doing. I think he believes that he's, maybe he's created a purpose for himself in his own mind that is not real, but he has a purpose and he believes in it, and I think that's what keeps him going.
Well, whether it's real or not, I think what I was saying, that Bob is a performance artist and he's aware of our creation of our own personality, of our own selection of what we will and will not believe or tolerate, or what we choose to pay attention to, who we are,
mm-hmm.
is everyone's unique this way. And Bob has a very strong uniqueness that way, and he's chosen. You have a lot of affinity for him, and I do, in certain areas, not maybe the same areas, you know? And, like, you like to talk to him about these...
The last time we were on the phone, and, I started noticing these weird coincidences, and I said, Bob, it was really trippy when I started noticing this stuff. He goes, yeah, well, wait till how tripped out you are when you find out I've been telling the truth about how old I am. In all sincerity. I said, Bob, your own wife doesn't believe that story. And so I'm perfectly free to disagree with him on anything that I find to be, that he's saying that I find to be either fantastic or untrue. But it doesn't get in the way of our continuing to have fun.
Stuff. It's irrelevant to what it is that you are attracted to Bob about.
Uh-huh.
And all that other stuff that you like to explore with him that stimulates you.
Mm-hmm.
My interest in Bob has always been about this performance, this this persona.
Yes, I meant to ask you this because as much as you feel that he's sort of a big fat phony on the one hand, you've told me that you find him fascinating on the other, and you don't find just anybody to be fascinating. You're a pretty sophisticated person. So what is it about Bob that you find fascinating?
Well, that's what I've said. I was going to do my master's research thesis on role playing because as an actress I realized that acting requires you to be able to do this body shifting thing like you said. I used to work in this workshop in LA with Charles Conrad, and he was the big name, you know, workshop at the time, and he would call me Amy. He'd say, oh, did you guys see Amy come out? He had this pet name for when I would go into this other, I mean, and it was just a matter of letting myself go.
Mm-hmm.
It's just believing a situation so totally that you become it.
Uh-huh.
I can do this. And most people that try to act are just trying technically to act. They don't know what they're fucking doing. They want to be movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to do it because of getting away from myself.
Right.
And getting into this place. And it's more fun to write.
Yeah.
Because I can do the same thing. Okay, so anyway, Bob had, first of all, I was attracted by his manner. This persona that he does, that he totally let down a few times when I was around him.
Mm-hmm.
And was real just natural. But whenever there was somebody else around, it would be this persona. And there's this whole fun thing, and I'm sure that's the same thing you got when you were there, and it was on some of those tapes that we had. But it's when you talk to him on the phone. I'm sure that that's there with you, even when you're exploring his categories and his ideas and stuff. You know what I mean with him?
Mm-hmm.
And listening, and you're asking questions. You're really trying hard to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't.
Right.
I mean, what I get intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to work on these ideas and try to memorize his words and his categories and all of this shit. You know that I'm not doing that.
Right.
But I have a sense of where it's coming from and what it's about, and it may not at all be, I can't verbalize it even. But if Bob isn't, how do I want to say this? I watched him with Caroline too for the 3 or 4 days they were here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting. And it's just, I saw a whole person there, a different person. And that I know that he is performing. And he's conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's what I wanted to do that thesis on was the fact that people, you know, how they have this whole theory of family dynamics where people take on certain roles in families. And when
mm-hmm.
one disappears, another one has to take over that role.
Mm-hmm.
There's the hero, there's the black sheep, there's blah, blah, blah. I've nearly never read the theory, but I've heard enough about it to go, yeah, it makes sense, I've seen this. But Bob is conscious of the fact that we all play a role, and he consciously does this thing, and that includes, because when he talks about Marshall McLuhan, I believe he's referring to this too, you know, Marshall doing these things that would not make him a real target for like the CIA or somebody,
mm-hmm.
by being sort of out there, by being Catholic.
Right.
So that he could just be, he's just a flake. You have to have this flakiness to you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be too in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
I just think he's just having a great time with the whole thing of realizing that we don't have a self.
Mm-hmm.
We all think we have a self.
Right.
That's one of the biggest, you know, lies that we tell ourselves, is that we are a self. And we are to some degree. We aren't. You know, these Christians believe that they come here with this soul and, you know, this self. And they have all these beliefs about that. the psychologists, I don't think, believe that at all. I mean, most of them, maybe the Christian psychologists, but that this self is something that is just, we're an animal that we create this self. Now, we may be more than that, but we don't know that. And we may be the thing that creates the self, but the self that we identify with in the world that people talk to each other as,
right,
is something that is largely a creation of the culture, the family,
right,
situations, and so forth. And Bob has chosen to create his own self.
See, now we're getting down to brass tacks. I'm glad we're having this conversation, because you admit that the bottom line in terms of whether or not we're the thing that creates a self, et cetera, is a mystery, that you don't know the answer to that.
No.
And you've never said that before.
Oh, I think it's totally a mystery.
Yeah. That's always been a slight issue with me that I'd never heard you say that before, because I get slightly frustrated with people who claim to have absolute knowledge of the way things are. And you were coming off to me as being that way for a while. And now I'm finding out that that's not true, that you do know that it's a mystery.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It is a mystery. When I told you that as a child, I decided that you know, I was asking myself, what created God, if God created everything? And I realized that I couldn't answer that question. I didn't say there's no God. I just said, I can't answer that question. That's a stupid question. My mind whirled around, and I'm 7 years, 6 years, 5 years old. I'm very young.
Right.
I'm going, this is, so I was fascinated with the people who believed they knew.
Mm-hmm.
They all knew different things,
right,
and they all knew it. They, like I have said, anybody who tells you they know the color of God's eyes is a liar. They're
right.
Lying to themselves. They're lost in belief. They're lost.
Right.
And Bob is not lost, either way.
No.
He may lie. He may do all kinds of shit, but he's alive. And he's not trying to hurt anybody.
Right.
That much I know. He's not trying to hurt you.
And you know what he says is the gap that, you know, he tries to stay in, the place where you juggle your chemical body, your chip body, your astral body, your TV body. It's the mystery body. It's the place where we really don't know. But it's a place that we can stand apart from the stuff we believe we know and say and recognize that we don't know. And I think that we can have a greater comprehension of the this idea of juggling, you know, I mean, for the, in the Upanishads and all that, I mean, the self, I think, is ultimately a mystery, and all of this phenomenal world is considered to be an illusion. I mean, I don't know who actually has the real perception that the phenomenal world is an illusion, because it feels pretty tangible to me, and it hurts pretty bad when I stub my toe.
Yeah.
But if we can center ourselves in the mystery, and then if that's a place where we can actually begin to make more authentic observations of what's going on in the phenomenal world, because all of our belief systems around the great mystery of life have centered around religious beliefs which were originally based on primitively based on the early alphabets, which helped to create a sense of memory and a sense of being able to create a story about ourselves and to write that story down and pass it on as law. And the early mysteries were based on those hieroglyphs and those making those like pictograms, and then the manuscript culture is when Christianity got its foothold and created the idea of the soul and so that story got embroidered into the mix, and then And so we have been living focused on this idea of a soul and of religious beliefs, but we've moved into a world which is inside, which where all media has been electrified and then put inside of a computer matrix, and we're still operating on primitive religious beliefs that came out of the manuscript culture. And Bob's just saying, look, if you can get into the mystery body and start juggling all your perception of what's really going on in the world, you'll notice that we don't live in a manuscript culture anymore. We don't live in the age of the Enlightenment, which was brought on by the printing press anymore. People are living in all these previous historical mental mind states that don't match the perception of the real world that we live in. And how can we juggle establish an ecology in a world where we don't even know, you know, I mean, I'm losing my words, but maybe you kind of know what I'm trying to hint at.
Yeah, well, I was thinking when you were saying that about, and I'm trying to get back to something I wanted to interject. I think it had to do with not confusing the mystery body with magical thinking. There's a problem with mystery and magic.
Yeah, you asked me what the 23 was, and, you know, the 23 vibe is the occult. It's that magical thinking. It's the Golden Dawn. It's the Freemasons. It's the occult.
Yeah.
And it has a place. I mean, I know someone who is involved in ritual magic, and he's created stuff for himself.
Well, you know, that's fine. I just think that that's not the place I particularly want to go, because to me, the mystery, those people think they know the color of God's eyes, too, or this is just some occult thing, you know? It's the same kind of thing, and I'm going to
manipulate
this thing in my mind. I'm for not manipulating it.
Right.
Not trying to just be there and follow my instincts and my intuitions and be in the moment and notice as much as I can of what's happening around me and sensing it.
Right.
And acting on my sensibilities. But I haven't always done that. You know, I mean, I was just really blown away that Bob noticed my neighbor's energy so quickly. And, of course, that's like, okay, maybe you could just say, well, look, I mean, he wouldn't talk to my father either, and I wouldn't go to the class reunion for the same reason that we do act on these things, and we do limit ourselves, and but in the case of my neighbor, it was a smart thing to not bother to let her come in here and bring her energy in here. And it's a weird energy, and I have allowed that for my own entertainment, and I realize that's a weak thing. Now, when you have Bob come into your life, you end up less drained. You feel better. But I used to say to I used to keep a list of the people by my phone that I would call if I did feel, you know, lonely or depressed or something,
right,
years ago, because I thought, I realized that some people I would feel worse at.
And they'll drag you into their story, and the two of you can commiserate between the fact that you don't feel good and they don't feel good, and you can commiserate with each other's stories and offer some sense of comfort, which doesn't actually liberate you.
There used to be this guy in LA called Roy Masters. I heard him on the radio.
I had a friend that went to live with that guy in Ojai.
Well, he used to call people. It was fascinating to people to call him. Yeah, nothing to talk about. And he would say, he says, these are your fiends, not your friends. And what you're describing, it would be a fiend.
That
you call to support you. He would be into this male-female, which I thought was fascinating because of the biblical point of view that he took.
Right. But characterizing something as a fiend is to put a value judgment on it, and it harks back to this good and evil, biblical thing, and that's what I didn't like about him.
Oh, I know that, and that's but I was interested in it because I always was studying these people, and they're what causes this? this theme and the biblical theme. And because I have to live with it, I mean, it's not an actuality, it's a reality. You know, they've created a world around their thing, and this world influences us. It's running a part of our government, you know? It's Sarah Palin. It's this Armageddon belief system. It's this me or you, good or bad. It's that very dichotomous thinking that is so dangerous. Yes, being an atheist or a believer, being a, you know, knowing it. No, the truth is, we can't know very much. I thought, you know, science doesn't know hardly anything. There's a lot of bad science. There's a lot of bad scientists around. They don't know crap, and they're always claiming it. I mean, we get a kick out of watching, and Terry's not a scientist, but he can do this. He says, did you hear what that fucker said? How could he say that? It could be this or this or this. I says, yeah. And they do it all the time. All the time in those documentaries on KCET. It's just outrageous conclusion.
Well, everybody's trying to make a living in an economy based on dollars. And
you have your job, and you have a certain level of I don't want to call it ethics, or commitment, or ideology, idealism, well, like I do. You know, I'm not willing to do certain things. I could be filthy rich if I were. You could too, probably. You know what I mean? Anybody who really sets out in this country to make money can make money, if that's what they want to do. I don't think Bob's about making money either.
No, he's not, but he's fortunate that he has a benefactor.
Yeah, well.
Carolyn makes the money.
Yeah, well, you know, but learning to not have to have so much money is a very wonderful thing. Not to value that.
Mm-hmm.
To live, you know, within your means, to live a small life.
Right.
Money doesn't solve. I mean, you know, I heard what you said to Bob about that. Yeah, it was pretty nice that you can get in a plane and fly. You could do that. But you didn't set yourself up to do that.
Yeah, and I don't really have any necessity to do it.
I don't want to do it.
Bob,
I hate flying in an airplane.
Bob doesn't do it because he enjoys going on vacation. He does it because, you know, like when he flew from Hawaii to Australia to meet with
Andrew
is because he wanted to help Andrew with his doctoral thesis on McLuhan. Bob thinks that McLuhan was talking to God. Now, he doesn't say he knows what God is. He says that's the mystery body, but he felt that McLuhan was as tapped in as a guy could be. And so, you know, you might say that Bob's relationship to McLuhan is like my relationship to Bob, in a sense.
Well,
you know, there is some admiration going on there.
I have certain things I've realized in my life. Certain, I don't want to call them themes, but focuses.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is to not be invested. That gives you the freedom.
The more invested
you are in anything, an idea or whatever, the least able you are to really see what's happening.
Yeah.
The other thing is to not inflate something to more than it is.
Right.
To me, inflating anything, that's what this fucking class reunion thing is, parties. Oh, wonderful to have you and Bob here, you know,
mm-hmm.
to sit around and talk. That's real. That's fabulous. But to have a gathering, you know, I mean the gathering even down there with the McLuhan gathering,
mm-hmm.
that was pretty like lame compared to letting Bob sit here and actually talk and interact with people who are paying attention and not,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what that was about, but it was too heavy, you know, too much on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you probably get a lot more accomplished in terms of investigating together with Bob on the phone, and when Bob is talking one-on-one with people, one or two, you know, he's excellent.
Right.
It's great. But those gatherings get to be kind of outrageous because of all the different energies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bob is very sensitive to people's energies.
Mm-hmm.
And where they're coming from.
Well, I think he's sensitive to whether or not he's remaining on purpose, whatever that purpose is. You know, his work, You know, he doesn't make money doing what he does, but he has a job. I think he takes it very seriously. He considers it his work, and he takes it very seriously.
Don't you think that that's your biggest work in life for everybody? And most people don't realize it. Is being what they set out to investigate and focusing on that?
Yeah.
That's why he can't do small talk with people about bullshit.
Right.
He won't. He spends so much energy on the other.
Right.
You know, I mean, it takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
To do what he does, and I think it gives him a lot of energy. But,
yeah, it's hard for me to imagine him hanging out with nothing to do, although he says that that's not a problem for him, because people will say, are you thinking about this stuff all the time? He goes, no, I don't think about it at all. Mostly I'm just, you know, riding the bus or taking a walk or body surfing or whatever. And then,
but my bet is he's not chit-chatting with people on the bus.
Right.
I mean,
but then he engages with somebody, and then that's what he's doing. He's doing this. But otherwise, he's just experiencing life.
Isn't it?
What?
Isn't your life like that too? Is your life much like that too?
Well, not entirely. I still have a lot of mind chatter. I mean, I have this. I do feel insecure. About when I hear the dreadful things that I hear about in the news, and when I think about the world on a larger scale, that can lead. And I have, on average, I've been sort of have been living in a condition of mild depression, I would say, for the majority of my life, probably since about the time I hit puberty. And so I kind of have to work to keep my head in the moment, which is where I like to keep myself, where I can feel the energy of the present moment and not be dragging myself down with heavy thoughts and feelings about how everything's about to go wrong and I'm going to die some miserable death or something, you know. Like you, I'm not that concerned about dying, but I don't want to die a miserable death.
I don't want to be disabled.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be without water.
Yeah.
that bothers me. You know, I'm a big water drinker.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's possible to actually be in a state of a state so attuned to the enlightenment of the present moment that even if your life turned into that condition, it would not even touch your energy or your experience of being okay. But I don't know anybody who's accomplished that. I mean, personally.
Yeah,
I think there are people that are just so completely awake. See, my experience or belief is that when you resist suffering, whether it be physical or mental or emotional, then you tend to amplify and exaggerate it. But if you're truly awake from moment to moment, all experience, pleasure or pain, will just sort of move through you like clouds in the sky, and you will always know that you're just that you're okay.
Yeah, I think that you're right, and I think that the worst pain in life is this worry stuff that people do. The worry, you know, about what will happen or what might happen.
Right.
And what should I do? The anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a flu and you're really, really sick,
right.
You know, don't you just wish you was were dead? I mean,
right.
When I get seasick, oh my God, you know, throw me overboard.
Right.
I think I always wonder when, you know, I think that when people go through, like you said, go through these things, I do think that most people become resigned to it. When I watch people on television going through these wars, people in Iraq and stuff, and you look at the pain in their face in a way, but there's also this just kind of like, it's not pain. It's more like suffering. But it's like a long suffering. It's not like a toothache. It's just like a heaviness. which is the depression that I think you describe.
Yeah.
A sensitive person looking around at this world and realizing how beautiful it is, how wonderful it is. If you really look at it, I actually, we have that fish pond now, did I tell you?
Yeah.
The rain barrel. I actually feel really sad for the fish now, and this is really stupid, because they're swimming underwater all the time. It depresses me sometimes when I think about those fish.
Mm.
I think, oh my God, they're sleeping under that water, under that cold water. And there I am laying in my nice warm bed, and I'm thinking about the fish under the water. He says, but they're fish.
Right.
And of course they're fish, you know. I can't imagine anything worse.
Yeah.
Than having to sleep under the water.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would think that a fish's level of consciousness and self-awareness and so on is so attuned to the situation, the vibration that they live in, that they don't... See, I think that there's... I think you have animals... I think all creatures are aware on some level or not, but not all creatures are self-aware. I think it takes a certain... I think the brain has to be developed to a certain degree before the creature becomes self-aware. But then there's a next level after that, which is self-reflection.
Yeah, well,
and that's when you can actually dwell on your problems.
Well, my point about the fish thing, though, is to me, watching the people who they interviewed who had their trailers burned out in this last fire,
right?
And thinking, you know, we looked at those trailers and we go, just like, you know, the hurricanes take out the trailers. I said, well, obviously the firemen didn't try to save those trailers. You know, they were saving the houses down at the street probably because they're million-dollar houses. You know, they didn't, maybe they didn't get there in time, but I mean, that's the first thing you think. We have always joked about how the tornadoes are always taking out all the trailers in Arkansas.
Right.
So, but you see, these are the people who can least likely afford to lose their place. Probably
right.
Not at all insured. They don't have anything. And yet you'd look at those people, and they were, to me, like the fish swimming underwater. They were there, or like the person over there. I didn't want to be in that situation, but those people were maintaining.
Yeah.
Well, it's just my house. My child's alive. My cat's alive. It's
right.
Fine. It's just my place. No, there's nothing left. And they would be just almost numb to it and do it, like Krishnamurti says. You know, if you're always preoccupied with worrying about something that's going to happen, you're going to get hit when that train comes rolling down the track toward you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, you're going to jump.
Right.
And that's the whole thing. And when you're talking to Bob, he engages you in stuff that stimulates you enough to where your brain is there with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you are awake.
Right.
And you are not, you're not embarrassed. You say, oh, it's great that Bob isn't embarrassed to act like a fool. You're not embarrassed.
Yeah, no, I've seen him get up on a stage in front of 200 people and start ranting on about this stuff that he believes and going into and going and willing to debate, not debate, but willing to engage in a dialogue with all comers. And, and the whole place could, half the people in the place could be irate with him. And he's like, well, come on, let's hear your thing, and I'll talk to you, and you talk to me, and let's do this, you know. It's not a violent. I consider debating to be a little violent because everybody's trying to protect their own point of view, and somebody's trying to win, you know, by beating the other person down. But Bob will dialogue, and if the level of hostility goes up in the room, he can go up with it without causing it to break into something violent. He somehow manages it. It's interesting.
Right.
We were down on the beach one time, and these two black guys came up, and somebody said something, and one of them took some offense, and they were very, you know, righteous black militant type guys, and it looked like it could turn into a violent situation. And Bob just, you know, he doesn't defend defend himself. He doesn't run, and he doesn't try to punish the person. He engages them and even raises the stakes and then deflates the whole thing, and there's no problem. And he knows he can do that. There's never any concern that he's about to lose it, like he's about to screw up or lose it or something.
Great with that. Wow. You know, what I was going to say about you was that you, too, are not afraid when you're talking to Bob to appear to be stupid.
Yeah.
And you just let it out there. And, I mean, you should give yourself credit for that, too, not just Bob.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a great quality.
Because it's something, you know, when we started actually recording stuff, and realized that this was going to be going up on the internet, people were going to be listening to it. I realized that I'm exposing, you know, my ignorance, and you know, and I have some trouble with reading, with my reading skills, and you know, I'm exposing all of that, and I'm going to have to let that be okay, because so far there's actually an increasingly large audience of people who are tuning in and listening to all that stuff.
Would you send me a link to that stuff?
Yeah.
Because Terry started reading Bob's book.
Yeah.
That a community, and I says you got to go and listen to those two talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find it, and I so send me the link.
Oh, okay.
And then because I think that whenever he would read that, he'd go, God, Bob is brilliant.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
But he always gets distracted with all of his other stuff, and he's always reading, like he reads so much.
Yeah.
But
Bob will always hear what it is that the other person has to say, and he'll let them know that he heard them. And it doesn't matter how stupid the other person is being in that moment. He treats everyone with a level of he shows them some interest, and he says, you know, like he said, we probably didn't hear this, but the other day on James's show, he says, I let people mouth off their ignorance because everybody, you know, has stuff that they want to say. And and because I'm willing to be there and hear what they have to say, that creates a charisma. And then they're willing to hear what I have to say because I let them speak.
Yeah, but it's
but you know, I get I'm getting better at it, but I get hung up in all kinds of subtle judgments when I'm talking to people, and that blocks the flow of communication. But I'm getting better at being honest about, you know, what's going on with me when I do have things like that going on. You know, I'm willing to tell people that I don't what, you know, what they just said is
doesn't make sense to you.
Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I better go.
Okay.
I said I was just going to come in here for a couple of minutes and look at me. We do this too often. I mean, too long, huh?
Right.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, well, I feel very, I'm glad that we talked today.
Yeah.
It's nice getting to think these things through with someone like you.
Well, I appreciate having a connection with you.
And so we shall continue.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Take care. Enjoy the beautiful weather.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.